If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a monthly podcast alternating fortnightly with its stablemate, the Martian Drive-In Podcast. Paleo Cinema looks at movies more than 20 years old in a wide range of genres and tries to find the cool, obscure or forgotten cinema of the past and brings it to your attention. Feedback is important, so please leave reviews on iTunes, email feedback, either written or MP3 attachment, to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru with a K at gmail.com. Or if you are in the USA, you can leave voicemails on area code 206-203-3299. This podcast contains coarse language and adult concepts, so you know it's going to be good.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 109. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing two films from 1949. The fact that they're both from 1949 is a bit of a coincidence, but these things do happen in a nice way. The movies themselves are quite very, very, very different. The first one is a very silly, I could almost call it a comedy, from 1949, The Fountainhead, based on the Ayn Rand novel, starring Gary Cooper and Patricia Neal. And the other one, which is a much better film, fortunately, is the 1949 English drama with a little bit of a supernatural twist, The Rocking Horse Winner, starring Valerie Hobson and John Mills. So, how is everybody? We're doing pretty good here. The weather's warming up a little bit. The garden is going good. We're starting to see some tomatoes coming out and all that sort of stuff. And I'm really getting into the growing things out of the ground and then eating them kind of headspace, which until a couple of years ago, it wasn't really part of my life. But now it is, and I'm really enjoying it. I think it's a great thing to be able to do, and I find it quite refreshing and fulfilling and all of that kind of stuff. And as you know, this is the podcast where we're heading into the Newton Mass time of year. I'm going to be doing another Paleo Cinema just before New Year's. So that's going to be an interesting one to do, and they'll probably make it something worthwhile. Actually, I'm taking a look at the calendar here, so it'll be done on Sunday the 30th. I'll be recording it of December, so it's not the end of the year one yet, but soon will be. So I hope everybody's doing well. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, I hope you're staying warm and that the various storms and tempests and elections and things like that haven't been too damaging to you mentally and physically. And financially, of course. We're doing kind of fine. Sal's got 5 weeks off work and she's started a university course. She's doing a degree in psychology and she's really getting into that and enjoying it thoroughly and making the most of the time off to catch up on things with that. So to get into what we have been watching, let me have a look here. I watched Barbarella again because I did it for the ABC radio gig, and Ivor and I had a lot of fun with that, and particularly with the My Curb Congregation music from Barbarella. So we talked a little bit about that, had a bit of fun. It was a movie that one of the listeners recommended that we do, and it's always a little bit a little bit difficult when a listener recommends it, because you really got to lift your game a little bit and also do it justice. So we did that and we had a lot of fun. The next movie I did for the radio gig was Get Carter, the Michael Caine version. And that went really well. Really tough little gritty crime thriller, which was kind of cool and very noteworthy. And we really got into the how kind of groundbreaking the movie was for its time, which was a really nice place to get to. Then we looked at the three James Bond films that Daniel Craig did. One week we did Quantum of Solace and Casino Royale, and the next week after I saw it we did Skyfall, and that went gangbusters. I really like Skyfall. I've seen it twice now. I watched it once for the radio gig because it came out here on a Thursday, and then I had to record Friday night, but I wanted to go and see it with friends on a Saturday as well. So I saw it, and I really like it. One of the things I did say about it, which I found really interesting, was that James Bond movies, 50th anniversary, they've been here for all of my cognitive life. There's been James Bond films around pretty much. They started when I was 5. So the interesting thing I found was this finally gave me a James Bond film which satisfies the me I am now rather than the little kid in me to a great extent. And the three Daniel Craig James Bond films do that, but particularly Skyfall, it's an adult film, not in the sense of waka chika, but in the sense of being an emotionally mature film. And Daniel Craig does really good in it. Judy Dench is fantastic in it. I really love Javier Bardem in it. And I really like the fact that they put in a Charles Trenet song, Boom, in that scene on the deserted island where the speakers are playing a jaunty little French chanson. I really got off on the fact that I knew the song as I first saw the film. And there's a certain weird audacity to doing that. And there's a weird audacity to the way that Javier Bardem plays Silver, the villain in this film. It harks back to the classic James Bond villains in a way that we haven't seen in a very, very long time. And I did appreciate that. Just those little touchstones of classic Bond that are all the way through the film, including right up to the ending. It's a really worthy film, and I had a lot of fun with it. And being a James Bond geek, I gushed about it on radio and had fun doing so. The week after that, we actually changed the tone of the radio gig because we'd done three James Bond films in a row. And we did Airplane, the 1980 film, which is known in Australia as Flying High. So we did all of those jokes about, you know, Clarence and... Yeah, you know, you ever been in a Turkish prison, all those kind of things. So we ran with that and talked about Zucker Abrahams and Zucker as directors. And just cleanse the palate a little bit after doing the Bonds and doing Get Carter before that. And in fact, next week I'm recording another recommendation from a listener. Somebody's asked us to do The Hustler with Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason. So I really like that too. I like the feedback that I'm getting on that too. Get the film thing freshened. It's not just what I want, it's what the audience wants as well, so I like that interaction. And I'm going to bring that into Paleo Cinema. I did do a bit of a shout-out, and by the way, I just hit the microphone with my thumb then, so that's just me gesturing while I'm talking, and I do a little bit of that, even though I have no Mediterranean blood. So, what I'm going to do with Paleo Cinema, I did put a shout-out because I didn't know what movies I was going to do about midweek this week. Had no idea the movies I was going to do for this podcast, so I put a shout-out, and somebody recommended that I do a movie called Let's Kill Uncle, a little known William Castle film, which I did watch and I kind of enjoyed it, but didn't quite grab me enough to do for the podcast. So you might want to check that one out. It's got Nigel Green playing an uncle, and there are two kids on an island, and the uncle sets out to murder one of the kids for the family fortune. And it's kind of an interesting little piece of work, and Nigel Green gets very over the top in it and has a lot of fun with it, but didn't quite grab me enough to do for the podcast. But that doesn't mean that I don't want recommendations. Recommendations work for me in two ways, one of which is makes it easier for me to figure out what movies to do. That's one thing. And two, even if I don't decide to do the film for the podcast, somebody's hipped me to a pretty cool movie or a movie that they enjoyed, and I've watched it, and I've name-checked it in the podcast somehow. So between those two, very, very happy that to take on feedback. So if anybody has recommendations, definitely pass them on. They'll be added to the list, and we can look at including them, or at least giving me a sense of what the audience wants, and I'd definitely want to do that. So having said that, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to do the sillier of the two movies that are part of the podcast this time around, which would be The Fountainhead from 1949, directed by King Vidor.
We're a weird mob, that is what they say. We're a weird mob because we like our grog and play. We're a weird mob, but our beer's great. We're a weird mob because we call everybody mate. Pardon me there, mate. You on your own? 'Cause you see, we hate to see a bloke, you know, drink all alone. Come and have a beer. No, I'm in the chair. Then we'll throw a spear to see who shouts the drinks from there. We're a weird mob, that is what they say. We're a weird mob because we like our grog and play. We're a weird mob. Our beer's great. We're a weird mob because we call everybody mate. If we ever say, you're our china plate, you can always reckon that we're true blue fair dinkum, mate. Come and have a beer. What's your name? When we're finished here, I'll take you to a two-up game. We're a weird mob, that is what they say. We're a weird mob because we like our grog and play. We're a weird mob. The beer's right. We're a weird mob because we call everybody mate. Come and have a beer, mate. Come on, I'll toss ya. Heads I win, tails you lose. Come get some of this in here, Dick. Come along. Have the one.
That was the late, great John Millian singing We're a Weird Mob, which was kind of based around the Michael Powell movie from 1968, They're a Weird Mob, starring Walter Chiari and John Millian, amongst other people. Yeah, that's a pretty rare track, that one. And it's very kind of typical 1960s Australianism, which I kind of like. I've got a little bit of a nostalgia for that. But I found a website that has a lot of these things that were only ever released on vinyl in Australia and have never been re-released. You can't get them on iTunes or anywhere like that. And I've grabbed a whole bunch of stuff that I haven't heard since the 1960s or the 1970s. And they're kind of cool and, for me, nostalgic. I'm not sure how well they travel, but I may throw a few of them in there now and then into the podcast just for shits and giggles. So on to The Fountainhead. I remember seeing this film when I was maybe a teenager. It was on television way back before you could record television, in fact. And I thought it was great. I thought the philosophy of a man standing alone and not taking shit from anybody and all of that kind of objectivist Ayn Rand bullshit that you get on Fox News, apart from anything else, was really good stuff. You know, people not taking shit from other people, just making their lives determinations based on their own selfish ends. It's a very attractive philosophy for a teenage boy. And in fact, one of the characters, Raymond Massey's character, Gail Wine, in the film, does say that he was, you know, Howard Roark's attitude takes him back to the way he believed things were when he was a young man. And I thought, yes, this is exactly it. It's basically objectivism is a philosophy for teenage boys. So I'll just give you a little bit of an idea of the plot line of this film. And if you're going to watch it at all, it has to be watched with tongue well in the cheek. If you take this stuff seriously, then you probably need to stick a shotgun in your mouth, because it's a really hideously stupid philosophy. So anyway, I'm reading this from Wikipedia. Let's have a look. The film and novel focus on Howard Rourke, an individualistic young architect who chooses to struggle in obscurity rather than compromise his artistic and personal vision, following his battle to practice what the public sees as modern architecture, which he believes to be superior, despite an establishment centered on tradition worship. The complex relationship between Rourke and various other kinds of individuals who assist or hinder his progress allowed the film at once to be a romantic drama and a philosophical work. Rourke is Rand's embodiment of the human spirit, and his struggle represents the triumph of individualism versus collectivism. The film stars Gary Cooper, Patricia Neal as Dominic Francon, Raymond Massey as Gail Winan, Robert Douglas as Ellsworth Toohey, and Kent Smith as Peter Keating. Although Rand's screenplay was used with minimal alterations, Rand criticised the film for elements such as editing, production design and acting. While it was initially panned by critics and lost money at the box office, the film spurred public interest in the novel, increasing its sales, and has since been reappraised by contemporary critics who deem it one of King Vidor's best films. Now, you can tell this Wikipedia page was written by somebody who watches Fox News, because the screenplay was by Ayn Rand. And it's turgid, to say the least. And some of the dialogue is pretty much unspeakable. But having said that, if you go along with it as a bit of a wheeze, it is a lot of fun. Now, I'll just play a little bit of a clip from it. And the thing you've got to be aware of in this film before we get started more than this is that it's really melodramatic, ramped up, tense. There's only one pace in this film, which is frenetic and strident. And the whole film is in that one tone. There are a couple of little idylls where they're sitting in a park, but even then, all they do is talk philosophy. There's no let-up at all. It's either about Dominique and Howard Rourke wanting to fuck each other's brains out, or it's about individualist philosophy. There's no middle ground on this. And there's no respite from it in the whole film. But I'll play that clip now.
This is Howard Rourke, possessed of a great talent, but unwilling to compromise his ideals at any price. Dominique Francon, the kind of woman who could enslave any man except one. Gail Winand, molder of destinies. He could rule any man except one.
There is no honest way to deal with people. We have no choice except to submit or to rule them. I chose to rule.
Ellsworth Toohey, calculating, ruthless. He feared no man except one.
The man who refuses to submit and to serve. Howard Rourke is the man who must be destroyed.
Peter Keating, selfish, weak.
You want me to confess the truth to them, to everybody?
No.
What are you going to do?
You have to leave that up to me now.
I have no pride left to stop me. I love you without dignity, without regret. Would it please you to hear that I've lived in torture all these months, hoping never to find you and wishing to give my life just to see you once more?
He's not any better than the rest of us.
What if he is?
And you get a little bit in that trailer clip as well of Max Steiner's very overwrought musical score for this film. It's very over the top and intrusive, kind of like the dialogue in a way. I'm not sure if I'm selling this movie very well, but I find it hilariously funny to watch because it's basically Ayn Rand in her life. She was a Russian emigre and kind of lived through some of the worst stuff in the Russian Revolution. Her family pharmacy was taken away from them. She was banished from university just before graduation because of a purge of bourgeois students. And the family moved to Petrograd. And then when she was 20 in 1925, she was allowed to visit relatives in America. She was given a visa. She went to Manhattan, saw the skyline, and just gave up any thought of going home. She was an atheist herself at this stage and really kind of embraced Americanism to a degree that even most Americans didn't. And a part of this was, of course, her philosophy of objectivism, which was basically one person of character and of culture and of intelligence and of determination can overcome all obstacles, and that anybody who tries to do anything at all cooperatively is automatically evil and trying to rip off the geniuses of the world. All that kind of shit, you know. Basically, you can understand where she's coming from because she did have an incredibly rough time at the start. But she's kind of not learnt based on experience past that age of 20 when she came to America. She hasn't really learned moderation and that civilizations are built out of cooperative efforts. I mean, there's a scene in this film where Howard Rourke calls for an ambulance to take somebody to hospital when they collapse. It's the character, it's his mentor, another architect played by Henry Hull, who people might remember from Werewolf of London. But I thought, yeah, well, yeah, ambulances are usually supplied by governments, as and hospitals are financed by governments, which are collective institutions. Hospitals are run by doctors and administrators as cooperative things. So you can't, her philosophy is kind of a bit stupid in that way. And in fact, the road that they drove along to get to the hospital was raised by taxes and by collective effort. So Ayn Rand's philosophy is really dumb. But in this context and in this package of this film, it is quite amusing. It's like seeing somebody standing up on a street corner on a soapbox spruiking stuff. Even though you find their opinions totally abhorrent, the sideshow of them doing so is amusing. And that's pretty much the angle that I've come to this film about. It starts out with Howard Rourke trying to be an architect but not willing to compromise. We don't find out how he became that person at all in the film. And it's really weird too, because he's supposed to be a young up-and-coming architect, and he's played by Gary Cooper, who at the time was 47 years old, which isn't that old, but it's definitely not ingenue material. And the other main character in it, played by Patricia Neal, who a couple of years later did a much better effort in The Day the Earth Stood Still and then went on to marry Roald Dahl. But she's 22 years old in this film. And one of the odd things as well is that Cooper didn't want her for the role. And then when she got the role and they were in the film, they had an affair. So obviously he's a man who changes his mind based on new evidence, unlike his character, Howard Rourke. Now, the other people in the film are interesting too. Raymond Massey, the Canadian actor, is in there playing Gail Winer. They give him a kind of gender ambiguous name because he's weaker than Howard Rourke is, and that's Ayn Rand's working. Kent Smith, who was in Cat People, playing Peter Keating, another architect, and again, one of those kind of straw man weak male characters that Ayn Rand throws up. But the most interesting character in the whole film in some way is Ellsworth Toohey, an architecture critic for Gail Winer's newspaper, played by an actor called Robert Douglas, who's very theatrical and flamboyant and really over the top. Now, Robert Douglas had an interesting career. He did a lot of TV stuff, but he was very good at playing smarmy villains, which is always an interesting thing. He did direct a whole bunch of TV as well. He directed all sorts of things in the 60s and 70s, which I found interesting. He did some episodes of the Disneyland TV series, Adventures in Paradise, the Invisible Man TV series from 1975, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, 12 O'Clock High, let's see, The FBI, Streets of San Francisco, Beretta, A Man from Atlantis, Trapper John M.D. So, tons of things. So, he really went on to have more of a career as a director than an actor. But, let me see. What other movies he's been in? There's another movie that I find. Oh, yes. He was one of the villains in The Flame in the Arrow from 1950, which was one of Burt Lancaster's early swashbuckling films with Nick Cravatta in it as well. He played the villain in that, and I enjoyed him in that. In fact, Burt Lancaster is in The Fountainhead, I believe. I've kind of, you only see the guy for a moment, but I'm not entirely sure whether it is Burt Lancaster or not, because he's playing a, just give me a moment, I'm going to check the IMDb on that. No, it's probably not. There's a thing in Wikipedia that says Burt Lancaster played the boat pilot who took Dominic Franquin out to meet a boat at a scene in the movie. I was a bit unsure watching it whether it was actually him or not. But I'm waffling. And anyway, so this movie, it's all about architecture. And the interesting thing from our point of view, there's a couple of interesting things, is that from the 21st century view of architecture, Howard Roark's architecture is in the school of architecture we call brutalist. It's kind of got a little bit of a Frank Lloyd Wright influence in a couple of the little bits and pieces, but most of it's kind of very brutalist architecture. And he does, as a part of the plot of the film, he does a housing project and gets really pissed off when people do things like put balconies onto his housing project plans, which previously didn't have balconies. And if you think about it, the people living in these, they were, it's almost kind of really weird factories for people to live in a sense. It's just basically his design, even though it was didn't have any of the classic fluffy bits that classic architecture has, are kind of unlivable unless you have balconies where people can look, have a view. And he's getting pissed off with the fact that they've humanized to a certain extent, probably by accident, his original design. Somebody's come along and said, yes, you need balconies in a building where people live so that people have a sense of their own space and that their household space extends outwards onto the balcony and by association into the world. Now, my sister lives in a flat with a balcony, and my brother-in-law as well, and their child. And yeah, having that balcony does give you a greater sense of space in a small flat. But apparently, you know, that wasn't part of Howard Roark's ideas, so therefore he won't compromise on it, therefore it's a bad idea. This is the kind of shit you're putting up with in this film. And to be honest with you, the love interest part is quite interesting as well. The whole idea in Ayn Rand's novels is that female characters are there to be dominated by the alpha male. And Patricia Neal basically decides, you know, she sees Howard Roark when he can't get a job as an architect, so he's basically running a drill in a granite quarry in Connecticut. And you've got this iconic scene where you've got all the rectangular angles of where slabs of granite have been cut out. And you've got Patricia Neal with her scarf flying. And down below, you've got Gary Cooper with an enormous phallic drill in his hand, drilling a hole into the rock face and sweating and showing off the muscles on his arms and all this kind of thing. It's an incredibly Freudian kind of scene, which is which has to be seen to be believed. And then, of course, they do have an encounter and she chickens out a little bit. But she doesn't actually say no, but it's almost the first sexual encounter between the characters is fairly close to rape. But she, of course, becomes dedicated to him as a part of that. And you've got to remember, this screenplay wasn't written by a bunch of guys jerking off. It was written by a woman. And basically, her own sexual fantasies seem to be a large part of The Fountainhead and pretty much everything else she wrote in the fictional area. Which doesn't make it any better or any worse than a lot of other films. It just makes it very much different. And the dialogue is quite turgid in this film. It's over the top, and there's a long courtroom speech which Gary Cooper has to make defending his position. What happens is somebody compromises one of his designs, which he does. He gives the design to another guy, so the other guy's career, the guy played by Kent Smith, can go forward, and he goes away on a holiday and comes back and finds out that they've ruined his design. The only condition he made on giving this design to the guy was that they wouldn't compromise on it. So he decides he's going to blow up the project, which is kind of a little bit of overkill, but the movie sets it up so he's got no other choice. He can't sue because of the structure of the people doing this building. And basically it's set up a whole bunch of these fake difficulties so that his only choice is to blow up the building, which he does. And this is apparently seen as a good thing in the philosophy of the film, because He goes to court. He's exonerated because he does this great big individualistic speech, which sounds like the rantings of a demented person to me. But really, he gets away with it, which is kind of interesting. So I'm going to play now is this short clip where the two antagonists, Ellsworth Toohey, played by Robert Douglas, and Howard Rourke, played by Gary Cooper, meet each other outside a building site. And it's just it just shows you the kind of stuff, the dialogue we're dealing with in this film.
Hello, Mr. Rourke. I hoped I'd meet you someday, like this, alone. You shouldn't mind talking to me.
What about?
There's a building that should have been yours. And a building is going up all over the city, which your great chance has refused to you and given to incompetent fools. You're walking the streets while they're doing the work which you love but cannot obtain. This city is closed to you. It is I who've done it. Don't you want to know my motive?
No.
I'm fighting you, and I shall fight you in every way I can.
You're free to do what you please.
Mr. Rourke, we're alone here. Why don't you tell me what you think of me in any words you wish?
But I don't think of you.
Ellsworth Toohey, the character in the film, doesn't really have a motive apart from fucking other people up. It's a very simplistic kind of viewpoint, but his whole idea is he works for a newspaper, eventually he's going to bring the newspaper down. He sees great men of various kinds, and his job is to bring them down, which of course makes him a great villain in that sense. But it's really weird that he doesn't have anything beyond that cardboard facade of being somebody who manipulates events and brings down people trying to do important works for themselves. There's a little bit of a kind of communist agitator thing about him, and maybe he's based on some characters that Rand may have seen while she was under the thumb of the Russian Revolution. But either way, there's no nuance to this guy. He's got a mustache. He dresses in a slightly Edwardian way. There's a slight effeminacy about him, which is considered pejorative by Ayn Rand and, of course, the world of 1949 in particular. But I kind of like him. I mean, I think Robert Douglas's over-the-top silly performance is about the only reaction you can have to a film like this, is to play it slightly camp and to play it and to enunciate the dialogue in that kind of English accent and poshness that kind of makes it a little bearable for the audience. I'm not sure who the audience really was for this film, because the book was very popular at the time. In fact, a lot of GIs had a copy of it during World War II because it was a thick book. If you're going to carry one book, you might as well carry a thick book around for the dull times. And so they knew the book pretty well. And it kind of, there was a buzz about it at the time, basically. But it's almost unfilmable in any reasonable sense. Kind of the way that Atlas Shrugged, the two parts of the Atlas Shrugged that have come out in the last few years are totally unfilmable. Because basically they are diatribes. They're people ranting. There's one woman's rant against collectivism based on her own unpleasant experiences as a young woman. Which, I don't have a sympathy for her philosophy at all, but I have a slight understanding that where she came from influenced the way she saw things and may have driven her insane, in fact. And there's always that argument being put out that Ayn Rand was basically a nutter. Which I don't have too much problem with as a philosophy. But the thing is that there are these over-the-top scenes. There's some nice set design in the film, and it is filmed quite well, and King Vidor does a pretty good job of that. But you've got this great chunks of dialogue that Gary Cooper has to spout, and you can tell that he doesn't really understand them because they don't make a lot of sense. But Patricia Neal does very good in it, and Raymond Massey is very staunch and formal, playing a kind of proto Rupert Murdoch-y character. Kent Smith plays the weak character quite well, but in general, it's a weird little film and can only be looked at with your tongue very firmly in your cheek. I think anybody who takes this film seriously at all is demented. But having said that, it's an artifact of its time. It's an artifact of a certain person's worldview. And while you can't take it at all seriously, it's kind of nice that there's that diversity in cinema at the time to enable this kind of silliness to go on and to be appreciated as silliness by us. I'm sure there are people who take it seriously and who see it as a kind of inspirational track, the same way that some people may see the biblical epics of the 1950s as inspirational tracks, even though they had over-the-top music and campy acting and Cecil B. DeMille's self-seriousness to contend with. But it's a bit of fun, and now and then I watch it just to see weird scenes like the iconic ending where there's a seemingly endless elevator right up the side of the building by Patricia Neal, and there at the top is Gary Cooper with his hands on his hips and the wind blowing through his hair, triumphant and incredibly phallic at the top of a skyscraper which seems to go about twice as high as the Burj Khalifa in Dubai. So that's about it for The Fountainhead. It's a bit of a giggle, not to be taken at all seriously, but enjoy it if you're in the mind to. So I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about a much more serious and I think more important film, even though it was much smaller than The Fountainhead, and that is the 1949 version of the Rocking Horse Winner with Valerie Hobson and John Mills in it.
La pendule fait tic-tac, tic-tic, les oiseaux du lac pic-pac, pic-pic, glou-glou-glou font tous les dindons, et la jolie cloche ding-ding-dong, mais boum, quand notre cœur fait boum, tout avec lui dit boum, et c'est l'amour qui s'éveille. Boum, il chante Loving Bloom, au rythme de ce boum qui redit boum à l'oreille. T'as changé depuis hier et la rue a des yeux qui regardent aux fenêtres. Y'a du lilas et y'a des mains tendues sur la mer, le soleil va paraître. Boum, l'astre du jour fait boum, tout avec lui dit boum, quand notre cœur fait boum boum. Le vent dans les bois fait ouh, la bicheuse à bois fait mè, la vaisselle cassée fait fric fric frac, et les pieds mouillés font flic flic flac, mais boum, quand notre cœur fait boum, tout avec lui dit boum, l'oiseau dit boum, c'est l'orage. Brrr, boum, l'éclair qui lui fait boum, et le bon Dieu dit boum, dans son fauteuil de nuage. Car mon amour est plus vif que l'éclair, plus léger qu'un oiseau, qu'une abeille. Et s'il fait boum, s'il se met en colère, il entraîne avec lui des merveilles. Boum, le monde entier fait boum, tout avec lui dit boum, quand notre cœur fait boum boum.
That was Boom by Charles Trenet, which you may have heard on the soundtrack of Skyfall. Now Charles Trenet, interesting character in some ways. He had a touch of the Michael Jacksons about him. One of the things that he got in trouble with during his lifetime, and he lived in the 20th century, was he was quite fond of younger males. 16, 17, 18-year-old guys were his cup of pastis, if you know what I mean. So he did get in a lot of trouble for that, but in spite of that, he was very, very popular as a singer in France in the middle part of the 20th century, of course, where everybody knows him from, La Mer. But his personal life was a little bit disgusting, which kind of blends into all of this Jimmy Savile thing that's going on at the moment in the UK. It's a horrible thing, and what surprises me most about it is the sense of entitlement that some celebrities have to transgress and to have negative influence on people because of their own sexual proclivities. I won't go into it too much more because this isn't really the forum for it, but I like Charlton's music, and he's dead now, so there's not much I can do about it. But I am kind of aware of his proclivities. It's one of the other things. I was going to do a George C. Scott movie for this podcast, but I've looked into the history of George C. Scott, and he just punched women around like they were punching bags, basically. And because of that, I'm kind of unable to separate his personal behaviour from the movies to a certain extent. And maybe it's a character flaw on my part, I don't know. But I'm having more difficulty with things like George C. Scott than I am with playing a Charles Trenet track. I don't know why. Maybe it's part of my own personal history as far as my upbringing is concerned. But, abuse of women is a pretty nasty thing. And for that reason, any movie that stars George C. Scott, I've got a problem putting into my podcast for some reason. The odd thing is I'm going to have to do The Hustler next week for the radio gig, and George C. Scott has a prominent role in that as well. So, there we are. But, boom, it was interesting to have that choice in Skyfall, and I did appreciate it. It's actually a bit of a reference back to the first James Bond novel, Casino Royale, where Bond was listening to some classic French chanson. It wasn't Trenet, but it was Compagnon de la Chanson, which were a bunch of ex-Marquis, the resistance fighters during World War II in France, who got together and formed a singing group and were very popular after the war. So that kind of does hark back to classic Bond in a very obscure way in Skyfall, and I, for one, appreciated that. So on to the Rocking Horse winner. The Rocking Horse winner is a 1949 English film based on a short story by D.H. Lawrence. If you look around the web, you'll be able to find a link to the story itself. It's not too long and covers basically the same plot as the movie. Now, the movie was produced by John Mills, who'd had a bit of a success as an actor and decided to produce this kind of small film based on the Lawrence story, and it's done extremely well. Valerie Hobson plays the mother of the family, Hester, who basically is the daughter of a wealthy English family, but she doesn't have much money because she wasted. Her brother has a lot more and is the executor of the estate and has been bailing out Hester and her family for a number of years because she spends the money like it's water, and her husband, played by Hugh Sinclair, works at a job that his brother-in-law has got him, but he's a gambler and he tends to be a very bad gambler and loses money. So the family is on a precarious financial footing, mostly because of the character flaws of both Hester and her husband. Now, the brother, played by a character actor called Ronald Squire, his name is Oscar, is very fond of his nephew, Paul, played by John Howard Davies, who a year or so before had played Oliver Twist in the classic David Lean Oliver Twist. Paul is one of three children. You don't tend to see very much of the other two children. But Paul really loves his mother and he wants to help her out. Now, there's a little scene just after she's received a summons for a debt owed because the family isn't doing very well. And there's a little scene between Hester and Paul where she outlines her philosophy of life to him, which is kind of self-defeating to an enormous extent. I'll just play that clip now to give you a little bit of an idea about this.
Mother, why don't we keep a car of our own? Why do we always have to use uncles or else a taxi?
Because we are the poor members of the family.
But why are we, Mother?
Well, I suppose it's because your father has no luck.
Is luck money, Mother?
No, Paul, not quite. That's what causes you to have money.
Oh.
If you're lucky, you have money. That's why it's better to be born lucky than rich. If you're rich, you can always lose your money. But if you're lucky, you'll always get more money.
Oh, Will. Isn't Father lucky?
Very unlucky, I should say.
Why?
Well, I don't know, Paul. No one ever knows why one person's lucky and another unlucky.
Don't they? Nobody at all. Aren't you lucky either, Mummy?
I used to think I was before I was married. Now I think I'm very unlucky indeed.
Why?
Never mind, perhaps I'm not really.
Anyhow, I'm lucky.
Are you?
I can prove it.
Can you, darling?
If you're lucky, you keep on getting more money, don't you?
I suppose so.
That's what you said. And I've got money in my money box. Lots of it. And I keep on getting it. So I must be lucky, mustn't I? I'll give it to you if you like, Mummy. All of it. You can have it all. You need it, don't you, Mother?
Tell me, how much have you got in your money box?
Lots of it.
Yes, but how much?
Over a pound. 22 and 7 months last time I counted.
And you really give all that to me?
Yes. Yes, of course.
Listen, darling. That's very, very sweet of you. But I don't need any money so badly that I'd take it away from you. I'd never, never do that, however badly I needed it. So just you forget all about it and go on putting your pennies in your money box until you have hundreds and hundreds of pounds put away.
Would I be a millionaire then?
No, not quite.
I can't imagine hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
Perhaps that's just as well.
Add to this little mix, there's a new member of the family, a kind of gardener character called Bassett, played by John Mills, who at one stage wanted to be a jockey, so he's very interested in horse racing. And he sparks up a friendship with Paul. And ultimately, Paul and he form a plan to help the family. Now, there's not much of a giveaway here. Paul, at Christmas time, gets himself a rocking horse as a toy, a great big rocking horse, rocks back and forth. When he's on the rocking horse, he can predict the winners of horse races. That's the conceit at the centre of the film. And both Bassett and Paul, and with the help of Uncle Oscar, conspire for a way to help the family. Now, this has an immense emotion. It takes an immense emotional toll on Paul, because Paul believes that the house is whispering to him. The house they live in, which is a fairly large house for the family's financial circumstances, he believes the house is whispering to him and telling him that it needs more money. And this becomes an incredibly oppressive psychological force on the child. Now, both his mother and his father are quite distant. There's a nanny to look after them. And, of course, there's Bassett looking after things around the house while his parents go off to parties and enjoy their life as if they did not have children. So the core of this story is emotional neglect of your children by a family where both the mother and the father are very egocentric. And this is portrayed really well. It's heartbreakingly well done. It's in classic black and white. And the director was a guy called Anthony Pallister, Anthony Pallister, who didn't do too much else as far as directing films is concerned, but really does a fantastic job with this film. And brings the world of the child open in a really interesting way. A lot of it's away from the children. There's a lot of interactions about the finances of the family between Uncle Oscar and Hester and her husband, who is barely name-checked in the film. His name's actually Richard. But Hester believes that luck is the reason why some people have money and other people don't. It's got nothing to do with hard work. It's got nothing to do with being frugal at various times. It's purely to do with the randomness of life. Now, she's come from a well-to-do background, of course, so she hasn't had that basic grounding in how money works at the grassroots level. And her husband, Richard, is a kind of weak character. He's not too good at his job. He's not interested in it. He's interested in his after-hours activities, going to parties with his wife and gambling. And really, it's setting the whole family up for an enormous disaster, which unfortunately, as a part of the film, does occur. Not in the way you'd expect. It's not a financial disaster that occurs. It's a totally different kind of disaster that occurs. But that there's a couple of really interesting options taken during this film too. When Hester finally realizes that money isn't as needed. In fact, a bailiff turns up and stays in the house until a 40-pound debt is paid. So Hester has to take some of her expensive clothing to a kind of illicit pawnbroker, a character called Saldurus, played by an actor called Charles Goldner, who's basically, he's a Jewish pawnbroker. He's portrayed as. And the negotiations between Hester and Mr. Saldurus are really interesting as she starts to get a hint of that reality check that she needs to be able to survive. And she fights against the amount of money he's willing to pay her for the clothing. And there's that back and forth. And you know, she thinks she's in a higher social circumstance than the pawnbroker is. But the reality is that she's not. She's actually at a slightly lower level than this pawnbroker at this time and in this place. And it's a very edgy and disheartening scene. Hester, being played by Valerie Hobson, a very attractive actress. She was actually in Bride of Frankenstein, in fact. She plays that vulnerability and brittleness and kind of really weird upper middle class, upper class obliviousness to the way reality works really well. She went on later, she married a politician called John Profumo, who was part of the Christine Keeler affair in the 1960s, which brought down an English government. She stayed by her husband throughout this whole thing where he had an affair with call girls and all this kind of stuff. So that's later in her life, but she's a very fine actress and she portrays this really well. And John Howard Davies, who plays Paul the child, is also superb in this film. He's a gaunt little kid. He's kind of at that age where they're gawky and skinny. And he plays that vulnerability and that not knowing how an adult world works, but wanting to help your family in a really intense way, and does work. He went on later on to become a producer, and he did a great lot of producing for classic English TV comedies, in fact. Really big stuff like The Goodies, for instance. And he worked with the Monty Python team. He did Fawlty Towers. He produced that. He produced Whoops Baghdad and Steptoe and Son, as a bunch of other things as well. So he really did have a long career and was well respected in the industry after finishing being a child actor. Had a couple of roles after this, but not too much. He got to that stage where he didn't quite fit into any particular category and then went on to become a producer, much to his credit. But in this film, he's heartbreakingly good. That intensity really does come through. And it gets to the stage, and this is done particularly well due to Pellissier's direction, where the house and the rocking horse become an almost demonic force in the life of this child. They're nightmarish things. But his family needs money, and through the assistance of Uncle Oscar, who finds out that he can pick winners at the races, and Bassett, they manage to feed the money into the family through the family lawyer, saying that there's been an inheritance of some kind. But as soon as Hester finds out there's an inheritance, she goes back to her old way. She doesn't take on that lesson she's begun to learn at the pawn shop. She goes back. So in the sense, the child Paul helping his family has actually not helped his family. Yes, it's helped them financially, but it hasn't helped them manage their lives in any way, and it's actually worked against them managing their lives. Not due to anything that's his fault. The little kid is trying to help his family, but because they don't take the lesson on, because of his assistance, they don't have to learn the lesson. Things just become worse until ultimately there's a tragic ending to the film. And this is a lovely, well done film, and it's been remade a number of times. There have been a few different remakes of it, including one short film version of it where Eric Stoltz played the uncle, for instance, and there was a version in the 1970s where Kenneth Moore played the uncle. And some of those get higher ratings on IMDb than this one. I've seen at least one of those. I've seen the Kenneth Moore one years ago, but this one I think is the best one. And John Mills is really good in it as well, playing Bassett. He kind of goes along with the kid a little bit and lets him do a 5-shilling bet. And then they slowly find out that he's really good at this. And almost reluctantly, Bassett's drawn into the family's problems. And trying to help, like Paul himself, ultimately, it's a tragic thing. And there's a great scene at the end between Valerie Hobson and John Mills, where that ultimate reality check is brought to bear through an interaction between them two after the tragedy occurs, where she has one viewpoint about things and he has another, and his viewpoint prevails because of that validity and because of that fact that his belief system is reality based and hers is not. Ultimately, I hadn't seen this film for a very long time when I caught up with it yesterday. But it's a really very moving piece of cinema, and it's worth catching up with for that reason. It's not a big story, and I think more than any film I can remember of its time, it portrays the neglect of children in a realistic manner within that kind of fantasy framework of the kid knowing which horses are going to win the race. Within that, it kind of portrays that neglect that some parents have of their children. And really, nobody in it's a bad character, nobody in it's evil. People are just living their lives. Even the bailiff's not unsympathetic to her. He's kind of very professional in what he does. And the pawnbroker himself knows what he can get for the clothing that she brings to him. And kind of, he's professional, and he realizes that she thinks she's slumming at being with him. But, of course, he drives a hard bugger because that's how he makes his living as well. There are no villains in this. There are only flawed human beings. And that makes a much more interesting piece of cinema than one where perhaps there are goodies and baddies. In this one, there are just people who are making bad decisions, and to the detriment of a child. And it's a very powerful little film. And I don't think it needed to be remade in that sense. Of course it can be, because it's in the public domain and it is a strong story, and it's a story that says something important. And Lawrence wrote this in the early 20th century, so it's not a new phenomenon. Neglect of children, of course. But it does it in a way that's very accessible to us now. And this particularly in this film, it's told in a way that's really accessible. And the story could happen at any time, really, even with child protective services around. This level of indifference to children isn't something that really shows up. It's not like a bruise, it's not like an abuse kind of thing, but it's something that can occur in families even to this day. And I found it really an important little film. It's one of the films that I treasure a lot more having re-seen it now. But having said that, it's a strong entertainment, but it is worth seeing. So that's about it for The Rocking Horse Winner. You really should check it out. There is a TCM page on it which has a few of the video clips from it, if you're interested, and it does occasionally show up on television, and of course it's out there thanks to Auntie Torrent. So I'm going to take another break now, and I'm going to be back soon with some feedback. That was James B. and the Royal Jelly Orchestra with the Christmas song. Just thought I'd throw one in there for the hell of it. Yep, we got some feedback. We got one piece of feedback. And that feedback is from a new listener, which is always a lovely thing, Wayne Cocky. Wayne says, "Hello, Terry. I'm a regular listener to the B-Movie Cast, so I've heard promos for your Paleo Cinema podcast many times, and I've been meaning to check out your show for a while now. I swear it's on my to-do list. The promo makes me laugh every time. Never thought about Myrna Loy having alloy hidden in her name. Meanwhile, are you aware that your show was recently reviewed on the AV Club website?" This is the entertainment hyphen review section of The Onion, the satirical news parody. "I'm not sure how popular it is in your neck of the woods, but it's pretty high profile here. The review, if you're curious, is positive. It mentions that you did an excellent episode about Warren Oates. Oates is one of my very favourite actors, and it took me a long time to realise that this same guy was giving all these incredible performances that I loved, and in such a variety of movies too, from westerns to comedies. I don't know if your episode covered Stripes, for instance, but there's a scene between Warren Oates and Bill Murray, which is gripping and dramatic, even though the movie surrounding it is a raunchy farce. And I can't have been the only one rooting for Oates in Tulane Blacktop over his two deliberately vacuous dead-eyed rivals, James Taylor and Dennis Wilson. Now I'm rambling. Anyway, keep doing what you're doing, Wayne." Thank you, Wayne. And to be honest with you, I only just read that comment for the first time because I put them into a folder once I received them without reading them. The Onion AV Club has given me a positive review for this podcast. I am fucking blown away, people. What can I say? Yes, it is high profile, and yes, I have a lot of respect for it, and I'm very familiar with it. But shit, I have been reviewed positively by The Onion AV Club. It's a nice little Christmas present. I'll give everybody that, and particularly Wayne, thank you for making me aware of it. It could have passed my radar if I wasn't careful, and it shows that I'm doing good things here. I get a lot of feedback, and I do get a lot of kind of kudos from people, but to have an objective third party do it as well is very heartening. And maybe I will keep Paleo Cinema as a solo and do the Martian Drive-In podcast with guests sometimes. Maybe that's going to be the way things pan out. But either way, I am incredibly blown away by this and not quite speechless now, but I did show it to Sal and we had a bit of a squee about it. And if I've been doing it for 5 years, it's about time I got the fucking thing right, I suppose. But thank you for everybody, and thank you to the Onion AV Club. Really, really appreciate it, and it's a heartwarming thing for me. Sitting here in my third man cave. By the way, I've changed the man cave. I've now moved rooms because, as you might have heard in the last few episodes, the acoustics in the previous room were pretty shitty. But now we've negotiated a change of room. I've got a larger room which is in a state of flux. Everything's in big piles everywhere. But it'll settle down, and I've got a sign at the front that says, Man Cave, enter at your own risk. So that's how it is. But I'm going to end on that very up note. I'm still smiling, in fact. And, wow. Anyway, I'm going to be back in 4 weeks, people. Take care of yourselves. I'm going to leave you with a question for feedback, too. And I thought about this while I was out driving. I took a break in the middle of that last email that I read out and went out and bought some munchies for a bit of a celebration. But I thought of a question for feedback. You ready for this? Now, going back to the Fountainhead, Gary Cooper and Patricia Neal were fucking each other silly during the making of the film. So, give me a few examples of movies where the two actors were fucking their brains out with each other, and let me know whether you think that whether it enhanced the performance or not. Now, I know things like, for instance, Harrison Ford was fucking Carrie Fisher during Star Wars. And, of course, you've got the classic ones of Burton and Taylor in Cleopatra, and not as portrayed by Lindsay Lohan. So let me know what you think and whether it enhances or detracts from an acting role. So anyway, I'm going to leave you guys on that, and I'm going to put a bit of music after this. But take care of yourselves. I hope you get everything that you'd like to get and everything you need between now and when the reindeer shit hits the roof, and after that too. And I'll be back just before New Year's with another Paleo Cinema podcast. So take care out there, enjoy your movies, and I'll be back then.
I've been everywhere.
Well, I was hitching a ride on the windy Hokitika Road when along came a lorry with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Hokitika, Chief, with me you can ride. So I climbed in the cabin and I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so many crooked miles. I said, listen, Ehoa, I've traveled every road in these shaky aisles. Cause I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Seen the geysers there, man, I've breathed the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my chin, man, I've been everywhere. Been a Hinamo, Wangaro, Akaro, Motueka, Toro, Wataro, Parongaro, Kororeka, Rewaka, Rimataka, Tika, Raka, Wangare, New Haka, Wanaka, Waka, Waka, Waraka, Mokadino, Awakino, Mangakino, Rongatai, Matawai, Kawai, Maratai. I'm the guy who's been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Seen the guys as them, man. I've breathed the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my chin, man. I've been everywhere.
My curry, hurry, you've been to
Been to Woodville, Lomasville, Darkerville, Lakatuna, Hellasville, Morrisville, Hunterville, Lutuna, Poot, Tiki, Pike, Greeky, Opa, Tiki, White, Tanga, Pipperiki, Tiki, Kiki, Pike, Greeky, Hoki, Timaru, Wamaru, Tokamaru, Totoro, Nui, Awa, Nui, Wonga, Nui, Tarama, Nui, it's all Hui. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Seen the guys as them, man. I've breathed the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my chin, man. I've been everywhere.
That pretty cat, what about
Featherston, Palmerston, Wellington, Tiamuda, Riverton, Hamilton, Picton, Ahinamuda, Mora, Kuru, Rokuru, Canieri, Mangatura, Generota, Maniapota, Kerry, Kerry, White, Taki, Poo, Kaki, Taranaki, Tiki, Wataro, Pata, Mata, Mata, Arabata. What's the matter? I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Seen the guys as them, man. I've breathed the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my chin, man. I've been everywhere.
Hey, listen, Hori, you've not been to
Rakehua, Paniatua, Rotorua, Waipawa, Take, Witty, Kapiti, Karapiti, Kawaka, Patia, Oki, Karamia, Pekaku, Waipu, Waitami, Makatapa, Pukuku, Aranui, Tamarui, Warani, Waipakara, Karawa, Taranau, Paranau. You know now, I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Seen the guys as them, man. I've breathed the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my chin, man. I've been everywhere. I've been here, there, everywhere. I've been everywhere. Okay, Hori, you've been every place except one. You sure don't need my help to get there.